four, three, two, one.
Insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link.
Link it up.
Link it up and take it away.
Take it away.
Good Lord, man.
Don't wait.
I warned you.
Don't wait that over here.
Yeah, it's not bad enough, is it? Oh, man.
I had asparagus for dinner tonight.
It's just not appropriate. Not appropriate at all.
Oh, man, my eyes are watering. I got used to Dan's, but, you know.
The paint is peeling.
My God, his walls are green.
Oh, this is wrong.
Yeah, it's that's just wrong.
It's usually Dan.
Stinky-ass mother... Yeah.
Episode 102.
102?
Is it 102? Cool.
102?
Moving right along. We're not one of those shows that does a show every day and does a 15-minute show.
Well, we're going to talk about one of those shows.
But we're going to talk about another show.
That does a show every... there's a new podcast out there called Twat.
Now, is that a goof on Twit or is it just something else?
You make that up for yourself. You think that...
Tactical Women Assault Team.
No, not that. It's Today with a Techie. And you can go over to www.twat.org. Twattech.org. Not twat.org.
I was going to say, man, you're going to get some hits from some people looking for other things.
I don't remember what the address is. Yeah, twattech.org. There will be a daily... hardcore tech related podcast, usual length, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes is what they're going. It is a rotating host. So far there's about 10 people that are signed up to do it.
Who's on it?
Droops, Dossman, Linlin, Fizone, Jay Hood, Nen, myself, Black Ratchet. Some of you probably recognize those names.
Is there anybody else with, like, a regular name?
Not yet. There is, who is...
Who needs a regular name?
There's a bunch of other people. Of course, potentially Pat Link and Alan.
Alan's going to do a segment.
Will be going on. So what we're looking for are people who are interested in doing a tech-related podcast of 10 to 15 minutes or so. The more people we get, the larger the rotation will be. So you're looking at maybe having to do 10 or so a year, 10 to 12 a year total, once a month maybe. Right now, the way it's set up, you can record it yourself. There's another way that we provide for recording. You can use our Asterisk server. You can call in. And if you want more than one person, if you're not in the same area, you can collaborate. You can call into the Asterisk server using a SIP phone or your regular phone. Get in there into a conference, which will be recorded for you. Then you can pull down the WAV file via the web when you're finished and edit it to suit your needs, add more audio to it, whatever you want to do. And then you could upload it to the Twat server. Now, if you're interested in participating in Twat, get a hold of one of us, the tech show, and we'll get you the information. The way that membership is working right now is what they'd like you to do, what we'd like you to do, is you, if you're interested in doing a tech show and you're not already doing a podcast, so to speak, to come on when one of us, one of the current members, are working, see if you like it, see, you know, ready to go. And once you come on, and if we know you and we know that you'd be trustworthy to do it on your scheduled day, which I'm sure won't be a problem, we'll give you all the necessary information. so that you can contribute to TWAT. And again, you can check out all that at twattech.org.
Because everybody needs TWAT.
That's right. Everybody needs a little TWAT. And that's why it is a little. The wife, when I told the wife that we were doing that, she's like, I absolutely hate the name, which kind of solidifies the fact that I don't think we're going to get any female podcasters on that.
It's going to be a pure sausage party.
Yeah, unless we change the name. So definitely check out twattech.org. You know, thanks to Droops for initiating that process. And it seems like it's going to be a lot of fun. There's already two.
Oh, there's two? I heard one.
There's two. There are already two right now.
Because it's every day, right?
Yep, it is every day. There's supposed to be one today. I don't know where it is yet, but maybe it's on the RSS feed, not on the website. I'll be doing mine on Monday. And then
What topic are you doing?
I don't know yet. I'll figure it out.
Who are you going to do it with, Droops?
No, I think I'm doing it by myself. Well, if somebody wants to come on, you know, then we'll do it the old asterisk way.
Why not?
Hootie ho.
Sounds like fun, man.
I think it is going to be a lot of fun. But we'll see what happens. Also, on the topic of technology, last week Link had posted his page, I think it was in the chat, on his iCandy.
For Fluxbox.
I, too, put up a page, and you can see it at tllts.info/howtos. If you click on that, right now there's no index page, but you'll see mine, anti-icandy.html. Let me post that in the chat. Somebody talk while I do that.
I noticed walking into the room today, Dan has a new server in the corner. And I believe you're running the Lug website on our website or no?
Everything, yeah. It is a new server. It is a very loud server.
I was going to say, it's the jet engine in the corner.
Yeah, it's a Pentium, Xeon processor running at 866
MHz. So it's old, but it's new.
It's fairly old. It's got a gig of RAM, 218 gig SCSI hard drives in there.
What are you running, mail services?
Mail services, IRC. It basically took over what the old one was doing.
It seems to be running pretty quick, man.
Yeah, and I noticed there is a speed difference in
Absolutely.
With the email and everything.
The mail's very, very noticeable.
Yes, so
good
there
job,
we go.
Man. What are you running, Slackware in there?
Slackware 10.1. Once I got everything moved over from... I set this up, a basic Slackware 10.1 server updated, and then I just copied all the stuff over from the old one to the new one and to make sure everything was running.
So what are you
going to
do with the old one?
I don't know. Yeah,
Skype.
I've been using this. I've been leaving this one right here, run for a while to make sure everything's cool with it. So it's been running for a week before I figure out what I'm going to do with the old one. But I don't know. We got a whole lot of opportunities with the old one. We'll see.
Cool.
We'll definitely see. Thinking about going up to Slackware 10.2, which was released with Thursday last week.
Thursday. Yep.
Yep. Definitely think about moving up to Slackware 10.2. That's always.
I've got it
thing.
On the laptop now, but I've only been running it for like 2 hours, so I can't really say a whole lot about it.
How'd you do the upgrade, Swarat?
No, I wiped everything. I was having problems with... I think I was running up to the limit on hard disk space and everything, because this used to be my main machine, and now it's pretty much just my carry-along right now. And just getting a lot of problems, so I wiped everything. Reformatted the drive, took all the partitions off, did it all nice and clean.
Do you have a separate home partition?
No, like an idiot again... Once again, I did the same damn thing.
You didn't create a separate home partition this time either, did you?
No.
Good job.
I just hit the enter on the install screens there, and I really should do that because it would make my life a whole lot easier. But I haven't.
Firefox 1.07 came out today.
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't got that yet.
Just came out.
I love Firefox, but it's a pain in the butt to keep up with the updates because you can't set it to auto update itself for those major version changes from 105 to 106 to 107. So it's a hassle to have to go to every workstation and change it, particularly because there's a security fix.
Yeah, it's a big security fix.
Two big security fixes, and that's kind of a bummer. But I'm waiting for 1.5, and I think they said that with isn't it with Deer Park that they're going to change all that, that it'll be allowed to automatically update the entire browser without having to do a, like a complete.
Oh, I think yeah, I think I read something about that, but
I have no clue.
So hopefully that'll all be changed.
And Opera is completely free now.
Completely free of ads?
Completely
free. Yeah, they
took
all the ads and stuff.
There's no paid version anymore. It's free now.
So what's the revenue?
Good question.
Don't know.
Have to talk.
And they finally realized that nobody bought it anyways.
I played around with it a little bit. It wasn't bad.
You know, I think the revenue is embedded devices. Isn't that what they moved to?
Yeah, they're doing phones.
It may be, yeah.
PDAs.
Phones, PDAs, yeah. Embedded devices, I think, is what...
Because Trolltech does... they have a whole toolkit for doing phones and embedded devices as well.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the same company, is it? Trolltech is the people...
No, QT. Trolltech is QT.
QT, but it's based off of QT, I believe. Speaking of QT, I got my book, so I'm going to start doing some programming in QT.
Yeah, you talked about that.
That seems to be a really good book. I got it yesterday, and I just started looking at it, and it seems like a really nice book, man. So that should keep me occupied for a while.
All right, you know what? In the chat, I posted the link to the to my anti-iCandy HTML. Let me clarify exactly what that is. I like iCandy just as much as the next person. I like a flashy desktop, but what I tire of quite quickly is having icons, having documents. Like in a Windows machine, you go to somebody's desktop and there's documents all over the place. KDE, I see that happen a lot, where you can actually save documents in the desktop directory, and they'll show up on the desktop of KDE. I tire of that fast. Applets, anything. Ultimately, I come down to liking my desktop to be completely empty, just my background picture, the pager, and GK Realm over there. That's all I need. And then I can launch my applications. I have fallen in love with an application called Quicksilver on OS X. And I primarily use Quicksilver to launch any application or open any document I have on my machine simply by pressing Command, which is the Apple key, shift bar, the space bar. It brings up a little Quicksilver Quicksilver application, and I start typing in what application I want to run. For instance, if I type in FIR, it's going to automatically go to Firefox. If I type in TER, it's going to go to Terminal. So it automatically fills in the application it thinks you're going for based upon not only just alphabet but also your history.
So it's an autocomplete, basically.
Yeah, it has autocompletion, which is really nice. So it's, you know, I've all but removed the dock from the desktop on OS X. So I wanted that kind of same functionality over on Linux, and I've been able to replicate a lot of that just for executing applications, both in Fluxbox and in Enlightenment DR17. Fluxbox I use FBRun. Enlightenment DR17 I use XIGE. Exige, I think is what it's called. But over on that page, you know, I like a transparent terminal, or I should say a less opaque terminal, depending on the way you talk about
it. I've seen your terminal over here. Half the time you can't see anything on it. It's just the background.
Yeah, that's the one downside of messing around with the opacity of the terminal. If you set it, you got to be careful.
I like the orange characters that you have running now.
At least you can see orange.
Yeah, the best color combination I've found is putting like orange on there. Because like black or anything lighter than that orange can sometimes disappear depending on what the background looks like. So,
And your background changes every
five minutes. Yeah, I change every 5 minutes. So in my Fluxbox, I posted some of my configurations, particularly my FB Keys is the application I use to do hotkeys under Fluxbox to be able to bring up FB Run by doing a Alt spacebar instead of a Command spacebar like I would for Quicksilver. And what's nice about FB Run is it does have command completion, so if I'm typing it in, I can hit the Tab key. Like I was on the command line, and it'll start filling it in. If I hit the Tab key, it'll scroll through the different ones, different options that are available to me based upon that. So if I would type in, what's a good example? M-O-Z, it would fill in. I hit tab, it would go Mozilla, or then it might go Mozilla Thunder Firefox, and then Mozilla Thunderbird, based upon how many times I hit the tab key. It doesn't seem to have a memory like history memory like Quicksilver does. So if I hit the tab, it'll do the alphabetical. But it's really nice. I like that. So basically, what I get down to is having only just the minimum on my desktop, at minimum clutter, no icons, no applets, except for GK Realm. I got the clock on GK Realm. I've hidden the panel on Fluxbox at the bottom, which I call the slit. And I do basically everything I can using FB Run from the Alt-Shift, and then using the control keys, I use Alt-Control right and left to switch between virtual desktops. And, you know, it improves my speed at the desktop a whole lot faster. It's almost difficult if I go to another Linux machine like my wife's. It's running KDE to actually launch applications.
You gotta figure out where everything is, yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah, I like KDE. Some people complain that it's all bloated and everything, but it does what I need it to do, you know?
You know, I think KDE's nice. I like it, but it's just...
It's not for you.
It's not me. Well, it's too much for me.
10.2 includes the KDE 3.4, which I think is their latest...
3.4.2, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly. Right now, because it's default, it has a lot of eye candy turned on, you know, the expanding menus and stuff, but...
You could shut that off pretty easily.
Yeah, I'll play around with it for a while.
Like that thing.
Yeah, I know. Whatever icon you're over top of, it sort of...
Blows up.
Blows up, yeah.
You can shut that right off in the preferences.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave it on. Like I said, I don't... This is on the laptop, so I'm not really using it every day anymore.
It runs pretty snazzy. It's not slow, you know. I don't have the fastest machine, so...
No, well, the laptop isn't either. Come on, puppy, get out of here. Scram.
The dog's going to step on the power switch.
That's it. There it all goes down. One thing I've been meaning to talk about the past couple of weeks, and we got a few minutes before we have John on, is Enlightenment DR17. Have you guys checked Enlightenment out?
I saw some pictures of it.
Which one?
The last release.
DR16?
17.
That's DR17 really hasn't had an official release yet.
What is that, a beta?
It's a very early beta, maybe late alpha. So DR17, I saw some pictures of it, and I said, I got to try this out. It looks pretty interesting. I haven't used Enlightenment DR16 or the version previous to DR16 in a long time. So I can't remember exactly how Enlightenment older versions are configured, and I haven't gotten around to playing around with some of the older versions. But I've been playing around with DR17. Essentially, if you look at my screenshots, I have set up DR17 to look almost exactly like my Fluxbox. Yeah.
What a shock.
And if you go to work and you look at my my Slackware system, that I have at work,
Fluxbox.
It's running WindowMaker. It looks exactly like my Fluxbox. Because I turned off all the docs, the clips. So it's like, what the hell am I even running it? You know, it's like every window manager I get my hands on ends up looking like the every other one I run, because it just turned everything off. And I do have a hotkey there to run the window maker, the run application for window maker, which you just hit the alt space bar, and then I type in the application I want to run.
But do you have a hotkey to run Hotlink?
Not yet. Based upon my directions here for Fluxbox and Enlightenment DR17, you will be able to set a hotkey to run Hotlink. I think the first thing that's interesting to me about Enlightenment is the configuration files, unlike other window managers, are binary data files. You cannot edit those by hand.
So what do? You got to go through, the panel?
Well,
panel?
They do have very rudimentary configuration utilities included with Enlightenment DR17. That's one of the deficits right now with DR17, is they don't have all those configuration tools developed yet. So what you end up having to do is you go down onto the command line. You have to run an a little program called Enlightenment_remote, and that has about 50 or 60 different things that you can configure by hand.
You see, I don't have time to do that stuff.
Well, I know. This is...
That's why
I know you don't have...
For me.
This is why this is an alpha/beta, maybe early beta, because they're working on the tools to do this. I mean, you could do some really cool things with Enlightenment DR17.
Sure,
only in order to do those really cool things, you got to go through a lot of hoops
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really, really nice. They, One of the first things I found out is I wanted to change my background. Unfortunately, you can't change your background by it's not as simple as finding a background picture like in most other applications and setting it as your background. What actually you have to run is a program called E17 Setroot. And what that does is it'll change your background, but at the same time, it creates a copy of that file. It saves it as an EDJ format. It takes that image, converts it into an EDJ file, saves it in your Fluxbox preferences directories. What they're working at here is not only can you have static images, but you'll be able to have background images with animation on them. So
that's cool.
That's what the EDJ. I haven't worked on trying to get one of those incorporated into my image. It's something I'm going to look into. But what I do is I run a script that every 5 minutes...
You can have a hot link animation running in the background.
Every 5 minutes, it changes my background picture.
No, it's just hot link. It's the only one that worked.
Yeah. So there's one that... KDE will do that. Will change your background. I believe GNOME will change it every couple of minutes. Fluxbox and EnlightenmentDR don't do that, so I wrote a script that will do it. I posted that on the page, too, and how to configure it for Fluxbox, Window Maker, or whatever, and EnlightenmentDR 17. So it's pretty simple to do. Other features with EnlightenmentDR 17, if you want to configure the root menu, you know, like most of them, you can either edit the file by hand and add items. You can't do that with Enlightenment. Or, like, Window Maker has that root menu utility that you can just drag stuff, little icons,
drag
and
stuff
add stuff. Or GNOME, you use GNOME Conf, and KDE has a simple way of adding stuff. Enlightenment, no. it's really weird because you bring it up the first time, and you see a window pops up with five options at the top. There's favorites, there's iBar, there's engage, and there's startup. Favorites is what will appear on the root menu under the favorite applications. iBar, which will appear in the dock bar down at the bottom. Engage is another type of dock that you can use. I haven't played around with that. Or startup is an application that will launch when you start Flux or Enlightenment starts.
What do you use for a file manager?
Whatever you want, Kate Conqueror.
Whatever.
Yeah. I guess. I don't think they have an Enlightenment file manager yet. I'm not sure. But you use whatever you want. Unfortunately, when you bring this up to edit the menu, you'll see a bunch of icons on the left-hand side, and you'll be able to scroll through them. There's a very limited number of icons over there that you're able to use. What you have to do is you start up the application, like, for instance, Scribus will probably not be on there. Hmm. You start up that application, you click on the border at the top, and you select edit icon. At that point, you can edit the icon of that image and set the name for the icon, the name of the application, and the executable. And once that's created, it will appear then in that menu on the left-hand side. And you can add it to your iBar. You can add it to your favorites. You can add it to startup, wherever you want. But applications will not actually show up and be able to be put on your menu until you create them that way. So it's really an interesting idea. Enlightenment DR and the configuration. What Enlightenment tries to do is provide a very artistic and beautiful window manager and couple that with lightning speed. I will say Enlightenment DR 17 is very, very fast. Extremely fast. I have not noticed a slowdown at all going between Fluxbox or Enlightenment DR 17. It's extremely fast window manager. So my hat's off to them, even though the configuration utilities are a bit esoteric. But you can read all about it. What I want to do is just a basic little overview of that stuff turned into almost a huge how-to for getting playing around with Enlightenment DR 17. I'll also eventually come around to posting my FB keys configuration for PPC because it is a little bit different than on the x86 architecture. Yay! And that's my tech tip for the week. Tech tip.
Alan is hacking that CVS is a video camera.
Yes, so maybe everyone will actually see video of us.
He's recording. He recorded a little bit.
About 3 minutes worth.
He's going to edit it up and maybe put it
on. Actually, we talked before the show. There is a video out on this because that's what got me... Dave Slusher from Evil Genius Chronicles put together a video of him doing
hacking
this.
It?
Yeah. Well, it's not hacking because it's already been done. It's basically soldering is what it turns out to be.
Now, soldering, what does that do exactly?
You have to pick up an old Palm 3 cable on it. You can find them on eBay for like $2, $6, something like that. After shipping, it comes out to like $6.
Is that the one that goes into the serial port?
Yeah, it's eventually a serial port one, but you chop off the end and you have to solder on a USB connector for it.
I'm ashamed. Transferring video via serial has got to be
slow.
Killer.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, I haven't done a whole lot with this yet because I only got it running the other day. And quite frankly, other things have been going on, so I haven't been able to do too much with it.
Cool.
You basically do a little soldering job. There's a website out there, and I don't have it on here because I just got new. You know, I just updated everything, so I have none of my links anymore. So I have to dig it up. But it has a bunch of programs on there you can download. There's a Linux one. There's a Mac version. A Windows version of it already written. And basically just install it, plug it in, and, you know, it recognizes it and downloads the stuff for you. And it spits out an AVI file. And,
cool.
You know, I think it's like 300 by 200, or 320 by 240, you know, so.
You'll have to post in the blog, or actually on the forum, maybe.
Well, there is one, on my blog, there is one, the first video I did on it. Basically, you know, 30 seconds of my messy desk, but that's about it.
Whatever you do with this one, man. Definitely post it in the forum, man.
Oh yeah, I'll put it up. It probably won't get up until later tomorrow night, but
cool. You know,
that's that.
We'll have to check it out. Ready for a guest?
Yeah. Another thing that I've been messing around with, the new site's been up and running great. I've been playing around with making it XHTML 1.0 compliant.
Now, what does that mean?
That we're standards compliant on the site.
So any web browser should look the same way?
Any web browser that says it conforms to the W3C standards should have no problem rendering it. I've been testing it in Firefox and Safari and Conker, and it looks the same across all of them.
What about Internet Explorer?
No, I haven't gotten around to testing it.
Not high on the list.
Nor do we really care.
Yeah. Well, you know, on the same token, you probably noticed that Link isn't here today. Did we mention why he's not here?
No.
Yeah, his uncle passed away, so he has to make arrangements to attend the funeral, which I believe is, what, upstate New York?
Up in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, so our condolences go out to Mr. Fezzanin and his family.
Yeah.
It stinks. Good luck, Link. I don't think he's on the chat, but I haven't seen him popping in. So tonight's guest, Pat, you take it away.
John Gorzin. He's an old-time Debian hacker and an author of several books, especially lately on... Python. Johnny, you there?
I sure am.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on.
Oh, sure. Glad to do it.
Now you're an old-time Debian guy, right?
Yeah, that's right. I've been around with Debian since about 1996 or so, if I remember correctly.
And what are some of the things you're involved in the Debian project?
Currently, right now, I'm basically just a run-of-the-mill developer, maintaining some different packages. I've been involved with some of the different porting efforts over the years. The first one I was involved with was for Alpha, and I've also been involved with PowerPC, and more recently AMD 64, and the port to one of the BSD kernels.
And you've written a couple of books on Python programming, correct?
Yeah, my most recent book is called Foundations of Python Network Programming, and it basically kind of takes people through from basics of, you know, how does TCP/IP work, and how do you access the network stack from Python, and then on through using some of the different modules in the Python standard library, FTP client, IMAP client, that sort of thing. That's actually my only Python book, but I have written some other books related to Linux. Had one called the Linux Programming Bible, which came out about 4 or 5 years ago now. Was my other major project. That one was basically on mostly on C programming and kind of a lower level system calls, that sort of thing.
So what are you working on recently? Anything new and exciting?
Oh, there's always exciting stuff to work on. I've been recently kind of getting into a language called Haskell, which is a functional programming language. It's very different from anything else that I'd ever used before, which is that right away makes it exciting. I've been playing around with MistTV, kind of enjoying that setup, and Asterisk here in my house. And, whatever happens to come along that's something I never played with before, I tend to get into. So, but those are the main time-consuming ones, especially Haskell.
Now, Haskell, is that an object-oriented language like C++, or is it more like Python?
No. It's actually a functional language, more like Lisp would probably be the closest one that most people would be familiar with. So in an object-oriented language, the object or the class is kind of the fundamental abstraction that you work with. In Haskell, the fundamental abstraction is the function. And it's kind of an interesting approach. You know, it kind of turns everything that a person might know from an object-oriented language on its side, really. So it takes a little bit of adjustment for the brain to get into the frame of mind where you'd be proficient in a language like Haskell. But I've really enjoyed it. The other thing about it that's kind of neat is that it's a lazy language, which means that it never actually calls any function or evaluates any expression until its result is actually needed. So one of the interesting effects of that is that you can actually have functions that generate infinite lists without actually causing any problem at runtime, because it will only calculate a particular element of that list if it's ever actually called for. So it's very different than most of the other languages that people are using, but it seems to kind of be growing in popularity here in the past year or so. And
because it seems Python has become very popular as of late.
It sure has. Oh yeah, Python is still far more popular than Haskell is, and Python has a lot going for it. It's got a good-sized community. It's easy to learn. There's a site called Dive Into Python that's great. If anybody out there is wanting to learn Python, it's a great language to learn. Even as a first programming language or somebody that's already familiar with programming. I switched from Perl to Python a few years back because I was frustrated with Perl. And, a lot of people have more than one language in their toolbox, and I think that's always a good thing to have. But I've written a lot of code in Python, too, and still do.
Is Haskell named after Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver?
No, I think it was some scientist. I think Haskell Curry or something, but I don't really remember.
And that's Haskell, right?
Yeah, okay. That's right.
I want to make sure I'm on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I assume when you were doing the Debian development, it was mostly C, right? C++?
Well, I didn't write a whole lot of, actual code for Debian. Most of what a Debian developer does is taking some software that somebody else has written and then integrating it into Debian. And that usually means writing build scripts that will build it and, generate the deb packages with all of the files installed at the correct location, making sure all the dependencies are set correctly, that sort of thing. And then also handling bug reports, sending them on to the upstream maintainers if appropriate. There is some code that's written for Debian specifically, like apps, dpkg, the installers, that sort of thing. I haven't really been involved with much of that. One thing I did write was it's actually called Debian from Scratch, which is a live CD. I really hesitate to call it a distribution, but it's kind of the same idea as Nopix, but it gives you basically a terminal interface only, and it has comes with scripts that let you pretty easily build your own CD with whatever kernels or packages you want on it. But I didn't write that in C. I actually used the language called OCaml for that one.
All right. So your live CD just brings up a terminal. And
Yeah, that's right.
And you said you just dropped
You know,
down.
A lot of things...
I'm sorry,
pardon
go ahead.
Me?
No, go ahead.
Okay. It kind of started because I was annoyed because I had some... had a machine, a server, that had a RAID card in it that wasn't supported by the kernel on the default Debian install CDs. And, the driver was out there and newer versions of the kernel just wasn't on the CD. And I'd had some other things like that. For instance, I was playing around with Riser 4 for a while, and that wasn't in the default kernels either. And installer before Debian 3.1 came out also didn't support the LVM, the Logical Volume Manager, which I tend to use on my systems. And so what I really wanted was an environment where I could just get a command line and kind of do a manual install, Gen 2 style. And so I decided, well, I'd whip up a little script that would build such a CD for me. And so when you pop that CD in the drive and boot up, you basically get a login prompt. You log in as root. There's no password. And then you can, use your FBISC or whatever you might need to do to set up your system or repair your system if you do like I do and periodically make mistakes that wipe out a file system. It also has a fully functional C compiler on there, so you can actually use that CD and compile your own kernel if you need to without having to have GCC already installed and working on your system, which can kind of be a lifesaver sometimes.
Cool, have to check it out. Now, you're into Astros big time, right? You actually have Astros set up at home, right?
You were dropping out a little bit there. Were you asking about Asterisk?
Yes, you're into Asterisk too, right?
Yes, yeah, I have an Asterisk server and here in my house, and it basically does the phones in our house. And that kind of came about because we have a two-story house with a basement and the computer's in the basement and not much else is, so... my wife and I kind of got tired of, running up and down two flights of stairs when we wanted to ask a question or something, and we were kind of thinking about finding some sort of intercom system, and happened to read an article about Asterisk about then, and thought, well, this might be an interesting solution, and so I popped it on my machine and started tinkering around with it, and just thought it was a really neat piece of software. So... what we have is a server, which is my old Alpha. That's our Asterisk server. And just as a very brief background, I don't know how much everybody knows about Asterisk, but it's basically a PBX, which is a sort of phone system that businesses might have, where you have several different extensions and you can call from one to the next and you have voicemail and all of that. Well, Asterisk is a PBX, but it's written for Linux, and it's free, open source, and its native way of communicating is with voice over IP. And so you can really deploy Asterisk and tinker around with it without ever having to purchase any hardware or anything, just by using soft phones on your PCs and whatnot. So I got that going, seem to work pretty well, so we actually have purchased what they call hard phones, which are basically look like a regular phone, but instead of a phone jack, they have an Ethernet jack on the back, and ran some Ethernet cabling in the house, and so now we have most of the phones in our house are Sapura phones, they're SPA-841s, and they link into the, they just plug into our network that's already here, and whenever we place a call, I mean, it looks just like a regular phone to anybody that doesn't know. But when you place a call, you can dial a different phone in the house, or if you call, make a long-distance call, it will route it over a VoIP provider. We pay about 1.1 cents a minute. And if you make a local call, it'll route it over our regular phone line. So it's you know, people don't have to know that there's asterisk or anything complicated behind there. It just behaves like a regular phone.
Did you say you have it set up as an intercom system also?
Yeah, one of the neat features about the these Sapura phones is that if you set up a special dial command in asterisk, then it will tell the phone to automatically answer and go into speakerphone mode. So basically, I have it set up so that each phone has two different extension numbers. And if I dial one extension, it will ring like normal. If I dial the other extension, it will go into speakerphone mode automatically. So it's basically like an intercom system that way.
Okay. Now, which model of Sapura phone did you say you have?
It's an SPA-841.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the only one that they make.
Right, it's a 2 or 4 line business phone?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
How much does that run? Does that run you?
I think it's somewhere around $70 or $80 each for the two line model.
It's not too bad. So they're like basically embedded devices. They have their own IP address, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they have their own IP. They have a built-in simple HTTP server that you can use to configure them. And they also have like a 4-line LCD display that you can do a little bit of basic configuring on, too. One of the other neat things that they can do is they can also pull down a configuration file from a TFTP server on the network. So if you're configuring a bunch of them at once, you know, and you want basically the same configuration on each one of them, you can set up that configuration once on a server somewhere on the network, and then all of the phones will go down and pull a configuration from that. So, I mean, we don't have that many phones just in our house, but I thought that was kind of neat, too. So if I do make a change, I don't have to go around to all of the different phones and change them each.
Because I was looking at the Sapura website, and I was saying, you know, wonder if it would be able to get away with using just an adapter for an existing telephone, analog line.
That's what we have. That Sapura 3000 is an adapter.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, mm-hmm. by the time you buy one of those adapters, they're like $80 plus. You might as well just buy the phone.
Might as well get the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have one of those SPA 3000s also. And we actually use it for two different things. One is, you know, we have DSL here, so canceling our regular phone line isn't an option. So I figured, well, we might as well just, you know, keep it around. And incoming calls to us are, you know, come in over that regular phone line. We didn't go with, like, a Vonage or a Broad Voice or some other company that would sell you a phone number. They aren't available in our area anyway. And the other thing is that cordless phones, there are some cordless phones out there that will use 802.11b and directly speak to a server using SIP, which is a pretty neat idea, but there is still, $300 or so and, have some issues with battery life and the like. Yeah, it's a very new market for those, and so we just use our existing cordless phone and few other analog phones in areas where we aren't at frequently on the other side of that SPA 3000.
We just started to get into asterisk ourselves. We've had the server now for about 3 months or so, and we did the install with asterisk at home, which is basically CentOS, and there's a bunch of scripts that'll go in and do the install for you, and that part's pretty painless. It's the configuration and the nitty-gritty stuff that could be a bear if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things about asterisk is, PBX is a complex business, and there's a lot that you can do with asterisk, but, one of the trade-offs is that it takes does take some time to learn how to do it all. One of the sites that I found very useful was a wiki site called voip-info.org, and they have a very large asterisk section on there, and a lot of examples, which are really great for setting things up over there. That's whenever I have an asterisk question, that's usually where I go first, to that wiki. But I mean, you know, it's a project. You know, it's certainly something for a do-it-yourselfer. It's not somebody that it's not something that somebody without Linux experience and you know, a little bit of patience is going to be doing.
Yeah, I found if you actually take the time to read the documentation, it works a whole lot better than if you try it.
Just winging it.
Yeah.
You sounds try, like you have a little bit of experience
no fun,
there, huh?
Yeah. You sit down and you're like, well, maybe this will work, or maybe this will work, and what the heck does that mean? And
yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things I found difficult, not only with reading the documentation, because that VOIP, what is it, VOIP.org site that you were talking about?
VOIP-info.org.
Yeah, it is a fantastic site. Although, it gets a little confusing sometimes when you're trying to do different switches on different things, and like in one place you put it, it's the switch is a certain way, and on another command it's very similar but not the same, and it can get really confusing. And then you got issues with different versions of asterisk too, sometimes of different configurations of how it should actually work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it is a you know, it's a program that's still being actively developed. It's evolving rapidly, I guess you might say. So there are some things, and you know, usually they try and note that in there, that, you know, hey, this is only in CVS or this is only in 1.1. But sometimes those warnings don't get updated, and you know, what was only in CVS in 2004 might be in the release version now. So sometimes you just have to kind of play around a little bit. You know, it's the other neat thing is that, you know, compared to the kind of proprietary PBX that a lot of businesses have and pay tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars for, asterisk is really pretty easy. And a lot of those, you know, a lot of businesses don't even have the ability to make changes in those proprietary PBXs themselves. So, you know, that's... It's certainly not the easiest thing out there, but it actually is better than a lot of other options.
It's a very, very powerful piece of software with a lot of capabilities.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
John, two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in on the IRC here. First from Carl, wants to know what VoIP provider you use. Did you say you don't use a VoIP provider?
No, we do. I use one called Voxe. That's voxee.com.
Okay.
And they just started up here maybe a couple months ago, and they charge 1.1 cents a minute for calls to the United States and have pretty good rates for just about anywhere else, and no monthly fee. You basically buy your time in increments of $5 using PayPal, and, you know, at that rate, $5 gets you lots of minutes. And you know, our balance, I signed up with them and our balance is still like 250, and haven't even had to recharge it yet. So that's pretty nice. They've I think they've recently started offering direct inward dials, which are where you can buy a phone number and somebody calls it, it gets routed to you over the internet, like what Vonage or somebody would do. I don't really know what their rates are for that.
We're using BroadVoice.
I've heard good things about them. I think there are a lot of asterisk people using them too. Yeah.
So we have like a real phone number, and like you said, you know, somebody calls the number, gets routed to our machine.
Right. Yeah. It's really slick, the different things that you can do with VoIP. One of the things that I tried one time was, you know, I have these Sapura phones plugged in here on my LAN at home, and I thought, well, you know, wonder what would happen if I would take this phone and plug it in on the network somewhere else. So I took it over to my parents' place. I made sure that my asterisk server was set up to allow the phones to connect from the internet, and I plugged it into the DSL connection at my parents' place, which is about 25 miles away, and then I used my cell phone and placed a call to my home number, and sure enough, that phone rang over there, and it worked, and I thought that was pretty nifty.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, you had said that you had Asterisk dial a different extension number for each phone to have the phone auto pick up in speakerphone mode.
Right.
Now, mm-hmm. is that configured on the Asterisk side or on the speakerphone or on the actual SIP phone, Sephora phone? How did you do that?
That is on the Asterisk side, and there you have to tell Asterisk to issue a special... some sort of special option in the SIP header when it initiates the call. I got that recipe off of voip-info.org, so I think it was off their SPA 841 page over there. And if anybody else is wanting to do that same thing, I think if they just head on over there, they'd be able to find the same recipe. If I remember correctly, I think... I'm running Asterisk 1.0, and I think that it also involves a small patch for people that are running 1.0, but I think it's been integrated into 1.1 already.
Okay. Now, you say that you'd like to get rid of your regular phone service, but mm-hmm. you have to keep it for the DSL.
Yeah.
Wait, who do you have for DSL? Is it a local provider?
Yeah, Sprint is actually our local phone company and the only DSL provider here. And they basically won't... Yeah, they won't let me cancel my phone line if I have DSL active on it.
Okay. I thought to some areas that, you know, like I have Speakeasy here, and in the past, mm-hmm. in order to get Speakeasy, I had to have a Verizon account, but they've since mm-hmm. done away with that I don't have to be with Verizon anymore to get Speakeasy. So I had to switch my phone provider. So I was wondering if, you know, I might not even have to have a regular phone service with Speakeasy. They'll come over Verizon's line since I don't even have to have yeah. Verizon anymore. But one of the concerns that I hear that they say if you get rid of your regular phone service is 911 service with is not yet fully available with IP telephony.
Mm-hmm. That's very true, and that's a serious concern. There have been some cases where people weren't aware that this was the case, and you know, possibly even some lives lost over that. It's also a really tricky thing to actually solve, because you know, let's say that I'm a Vonage or BroadVoice customer or whatnot, and you know, I can be a customer of theirs and not have an Asterisk server or anything like that. I could just have my SPA 841, configure it, hook up directly to their service, or a adapter like that SPA 3000 or whatnot. And I can take, you know, I could be here at home, or I could take it across the country, or I could take it to Germany or whatever. It doesn't matter where I am physically. I can still use that same service from BroadVoice or Vonage. And so... their dilemma is, well, if somebody dials 911, where exactly is that call supposed to be connected to? Because, you know, there's no longer they don't know where I am geographically necessarily. They can maybe make some guesses based on the IP address that I'm coming in from, there's nothing as rock solid as... the phone company has a database and knows exactly where this particular phone line goes to. I know the FCC has been making some noise about this. I don't know exactly what the state of that is. I think that what I've seen most places doing is putting a warning up that says, "Hey, you know, you can't use this for emergency calls to 911."
Well, wouldn't putting GPS chips in the phone maybe remedy some of that?
That could help. That would probably get you to about the point where cell phones are, where you know, they would basically call whatever call center is in the area where your tower you're currently associated is. One problem with that, though, is that GPS signals don't really penetrate into buildings real well. So, you know, if you've ever tried using a GPS receiver indoors, especially if you're away from windows, it often won't work. And, you know, most people are going to be using this kind of service indoors, so, you know, it might not quite be the kind of silver bullet to really finally solve that problem that they'd like.
We'll just have to go back to a tin can and a string.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, what they can do is they can ask you, well, hey, you know, what's your home address? And as long as you're accessing it from home, you know, if you dial 911, it could connect you to the correct place. But if you take your adapter with you somewhere else, you know, if you're in New York and you dial 911 at the call center in Denver, that's not going to help you very much.
No, not really. This is what payphones are for.
You can't find them. They don't exist anymore. You don't see them anymore that much.
What, payphones?
Payphones. Because everybody's got a cell phone.
You downtown.
What are you going to do?
It's exciting stuff. We're gonna try to talk to Mark Spencer from Digium, which is the company behind Astros.
Be
so I'm trying to line that up.
Mm-hmm.
No,
yeah, Digium... They actually also make some hardware related to Asterisk. They also make basically a PCI card that does the same thing as that SPA 3000, and they also have some things like for T1s, if you know, for businesses.
Yeah, their business model is basically they're a hardware vendor, and they provide support mm-hmm. for the product, but they're giving away the application, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know how they're doing financially, but it seems like it's a really smart plan because, you know, they get a lot of people interested in Asterisk, familiar with Asterisk. You got, you know, people like me and you guys that, you know, heard about it. It's free. Let's try it out, see what it does. And it turns out it's pretty good. And, I mean, I think it's a really good plan on their part.
From what I heard, and I think this was on BinRev, I heard this, that if you develop four asterisks, the code is actually the property of
Digium.
Digium becomes a property of Digium, and you know they can elect to release it or not. But it's not like other open source projects where you could just contribute and everybody can share and share alike. I heard that it actually becomes a property of Digium, and they decide what they're going to do with it.
So what is it? Like
yeah.
Some kind of modified open source license?
Something like that.
Well, what happens is they have, I think Asterisk itself is under the GPL or something similar. I don't remember exactly. But they also make a proprietary version that maybe has some, you know, extra whatever whiz-bang features they add to it. And so in order to be able to legally release that proprietary version also, they ask that people that contribute basically assign the copyright for their contributions to Digium. I mean, it's kind of the same concept, like FSF does that with Emacs, just because they want to make sure that they have full control over the code and everything. So, I mean, that's basically what it is there. It's you know, anybody could still take the GPL version and fork it or, you know, use it in project or whatever they want to do there. It's just that if you want to get code into the into Digium's branch, then you have to assign the copyright over to them and you know, understand that they will probably release it in a proprietary fashion also.
I mean the potential is pretty great for Asterisk. It has the potential to be like, you know, the new version, the new Apache, so to speak. Remember how Apache mm-hmm. was when it first came out? Everybody
yeah.
was running it. I really think yeah. that Asterisk has the opportunity to do the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's so very scalable, kind of like Linux itself. You know, you can run it in a small home situation, two phones, one phone, whatever. Or, I mean, there are some pretty large companies that are on the Asterisk list that are using it and some pretty large installations, too.
Very, very, very powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just quick question. I don't know if this is related to you or not, John, but on the original thread of the email that was going between you mm-hmm. and Pat, It's his Motorola V551.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
What was that? What's that about?
Basically, I picked up a Motorola V551 phone, which is a pretty nice phone. It has Bluetooth. It takes pictures. It records a voice. And basically, Singular is my provider, and they charge you 25 cents to, if you take a picture and you want to email it to yourself, they charge you 25 cents. So I'm like, there's got to be a way of getting off, you know, the pictures or the voice recordings off of there. So I did a Google search, and I found a blog posting on John's blog about doing the same exact thing. And there's a whole suite of tools available to do hacking on Bluetooth-enabled phones.
Yeah. That's basically the exact dilemma that I ran into. I thought it was silly to have to pay to download these 640 by 480 JPEGs off the phone. And also thought it was silly to buy, you know, a $30 USB cable for it, basically. And so my laptop had Bluetooth on it, and so I thought, well, let's see if I can get it off for free. I did some tinkering around. Don't actually remember exactly what all I did, but it turns out that the new release of KDE, it's not yet actually it's kind of going into SID at the moment, but the new release of KDE, I think the 3.4 or something.
3.4.2.
It has a nice Bluetooth layer in it. It kind of integrates with Conqueror. So I kind of got the Bluetooth layer set up in Linux, and then with the KDE tools, I was able to pull up the phone and basically copy all the pictures down to my local PC and also upload MP3s to use as ringtones.
Now,
which
I was having problems with the pin. I was able to connect to the phone. I was able to ping it, and then I was able to connect it with the KDE Bluetooth. I opened up the application. It got the connection. On my phone, I saw that it was connecting. It asked me if I wanted to connect to the workstation. I would say yes, and it would ask for a PIN number. Now, the PIN number that I had, there's this configuration file where you put the PIN in. Mm-hmm. I was assuming that it was the same number. For whatever reason, it wasn't accepting that PIN number that was in that configuration file. I was wondering.
I also had a problem relating to the PIN, and I think what was trying to happen, this may not be the same problem that you were having, but my problem was that when I tried to connect to the phone from the Linux machine, it tried to run this some sort of PIN pop-up program written in GTK, I believe.
Right.
That would pop up a box on my desktop and prompt me for the PIN for the phone. And that program, for whatever reason, never worked. It would crash. And but I think the interface was pretty simple. Like, it just expected this program to write out a file someplace with the PIN number to use. So I just wrote a little shell script or something to do that. I don't have my laptop here with me right now, or else I'd tell you exactly what it was. But, I mean, it was one of those things that was kind of had me stumped for a while, but then the solution was pretty easy. I still don't know what exactly went wrong there with that PIN pop-up program. Is that the same problem that you were having?
Same exact problem.
Yeah, there's a out there in the Bluetooth one of those Bluetooth configuration files that names the program that it calls, and you know, some sort of GTK PIN pop-up or something, and it turns out that it just either, I forget exactly if it just echoes the PIN to standard output or if it creates a file out there someplace, but I just wrote a little shell script that did that. I knew what the PIN on the phone was, and
the PIN on the phone, did you have to set that prior to it? See, I didn't have a PIN set up, and when a connection was made from the Linux box, the phone would ask for the PIN number.
The phone would ask for the PIN number?
Yeah.
Yeah, you also can set a PIN for the Linux. I mean, it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah.
Either side can have a PIN, and that's out there in that one of those config files too. The PIN for the Linux machine. I'm trying to remember on the phone. I can't remember if it was like a 0000 or 1234.
Yeah, it's one of those 1234000.
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember if there was an option in there to go and change it or not, but out there in the tools menu, connections, Bluetooth, if it's somewhere, it should be under there. But I can't remember if I actually had to change that or not. I don't think I did.
But it's pretty cool, though. There's a lot you could do. There's a whole community out there of people hacking their cell phones.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the singular phones, they use the GSM. And it seems like, I don't really know this for sure, but from looking at some of the utilities out there, that there's a kind of a standard for communicating with GSM phones to do things like send text messages, have the phone dial, you know, synchronize the phone book that's stored in the phone, that sort of thing. There are some tools out there available for Linux that will do that. And those tools, you can run them over Bluetooth, but they use the basically the serial emulation. I think it's some sort of, what do they call it, TTY or something for Bluetooth to communicate with the phone. And you can also use that same emulation to, if you have data service on your phone, to basically establish, dial up your internet provider and establish a PPP session.
It seems that it's mostly Java applications running in there. Like, there's like a little web browser on there.
Is that Opera?
I have no idea. It's Java, but Opera's Qt, I believe.
Yeah, there is some sort of embedded browser on the phone, and I mean it will also run these what I call them, the midlets, these kind of small Java applications that you can download on the phone. A lot of them, you know, you can go to Singular's website and pay, you know, $5 or whatever each, but there are some. I found some sites out there that where you could download them for free, too.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is they try to get you to buy ringtones, you know, for whatever, so many dollars each.
Ringtones are such a rip-off. Oh,
it's such a scam.
That is so ridiculous.
$3.99 for a song you can, for a portion of a song that you can buy for 99 cents on iTunes or one of the other ones that are
right
out there, where you can get off the internet for free.
Yeah.
That's right.
You can put any MP3 file on there.
That's right. It has to take a kind of a lower bit rate. I think it kind of maxes out at about 96 kilobit. But it's a phone, so that'll be plenty high quality for that. But you can just upload those with Bluetooth, and I've done that on my phone. What I wanted was I wanted my phone to sound like a phone, and it only came with a couple of one actual ringing sound, and so I pulled up Google and searched for ringers that sounded like a phone, and somebody had made a recording of a 1950 Northern Electric phone.
That's cool.
That's the kind you need to have on a phone.
Yep,
a real bell is what you need.
That's right. So I just pulled that down and coded it into an MP3 and uploaded it using Bluetooth and. So I can always tell when somebody's calling my phone now.
Yeah, I have problems uploading ringtones on because I have a Verizon, and they cripple that really bad. So it ends up that you have to, like, actually record a message. And so I did my own custom one by holding the microphone of the phone up to a speaker on it, playing back what I wanted to, and then, you know, stopping it that way. And it sort of worked,
yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the crappy way of doing it, but... Verizon limits what you can do, and even hacking, unless you have the cable for it. I don't feel like buying the cable to do it.
Yeah, that's just what's cool about the newer phones. They're all Bluetooth enabled.
Yeah, but Verizon cripples Bluetooth.
Well, the whole thing with Bluetooth is it's pretty easy to hack, not for nothing. Like if you go to the system, what's the big hacker conference out in Vegas that groups went to?
DEF CON.
You go to DEF CON, they... You walk in with a Bluetooth-enabled phone, and 9 times out of 10, they'll hack your phone by the time you leave.
Yeah.
Don't use the Mac machine there.
Yeah. More toys.
Are all your machines running Debian over there?
Almost all of them. We have one Mac in the house that's running OS X. And I use that mainly for video editing, but other than that, it's my wife's main machine. But I've got a Athlon 64 box that's my main desktop. I have a old 600 megahertz alpha. That's my Asterisk server and firewall. And I also have a one of the HP tablet PCs that I picked up recently that's also running Debian. That's been kind of an interesting machine to work with. It, most of the hardware is supported in that thing. And the tablet actually does work. I did have a PowerBook at one time that I ran Debian on, mainly because OS X was so slow I couldn't really take it. It was like a 400 megahertz unit, and Linux actually ran a lot faster on there than OS X did.
Wow.
What do you think about Ubuntu? We had spoken to Ian Murdoch not too long ago. And he was talking about, you know, his fear that Ubuntu will become so forked that it's totally incompatible with Debian.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting to talk to Ian. I'll have to listen to that because I used to work for his company, Progeny. So he used to be my boss, but actually took me on probably the most unusual job interview ever, which involved hiking down a mountain in Arizona. But that's kind of off the topic there. I haven't ever used Ubuntu myself, but you know, there have been these periodic squabbles about them forking and whatnot. My opinion is that they're doing a lot of good for Debian. You know, they've got people working on X and on desktop issues, which have, well, you know, they haven't traditionally been Debian's strongest points, really. And you know, they're putting all their code out there, and some of it does make it back into Debian. Some of them are participating with, you know, maintaining Debian packages. Some of their developers are Debian developers also. Most of the problems really have been, I think, communication issues, where, you know, they may have some code out there, and Debian developers don't see it or whatnot. And I mean, it's hard when you're making a distribution that has, you know, some tens of thousands of packages, and you're trying to integrate them all. It's not the easiest thing to get all of those little patches back to the back into Debian, you know, just from a management perspective on their side.
There seem to be a lot of Debian offshoots these days.
You know, I have kind of lost track of all of them. You know, there for a while you could count them on one hand, and you know, anymore you've got Debian derivatives and then derivatives of those, and there sure are quite a few out there. I don't know how many RPM-based distributions there are these days either, but for whatever reason, it seems like you know, Debian is becoming kind of the place to start for a lot of people if they're wanting to make their own distribution, which, oddly enough, is what Ian Murdoch, one of the goals that he had when he started the project.
And you made your own live CD from Debian. Right back to the beginning, John. How about that, huh?
Sure. Yeah, it's, well, like, you know, like I said, there were a couple things that were bugging me that I wanted some support in the default kernels for in the installer, and you know, every so often I'll play around with Gen 2 or NetBSD or whatever, and I like to see other ideas that people have and other approaches that people take to problems, and I really like the Gen 2 idea of, you know, when you boot from the installation CD, you basically get a command prompt, and the installation manual walks you through the commands that you would run to install the distribution on your machine. I thought, you know, this is really neat and an easy way to make a installer that's portable to a lot of platforms and still very flexible. And so I decided, well, you know, we can do this with Debian too, because Debian already has tools that will let you bootstrap it, you know, onto an existing hard disk partition or whatever, And so what, it's not really all that hard to install Debian from such an environment. And I was, for various reasons, I wasn't really all that happy with my Gen 2 system once I actually got it installed. So I thought, well, I'll just see what I can do to make the same sort of thing work with Debian. So basically, you boot up from the CD. It brings up Grub. When you boot it up, it gives you a choice of a few different kernels. Actually, from a single CD, you can install both a i386 AMD64 distribution. It has both the 32-bit and the 64-bit kernels on there, and the both 32-bit and 64-bit packages are also on the CD. So you know, that's kind of the main thing that I use it for, installation and kind of a rescue CD. Not everybody uses it for that purpose. The script that I use to generate the images, it basically has a config file where you can list what all you want to put on there, and you basically list whatever Debian packages you want to be on that live CD, as well as any extra files or kernels you want to put on there. So, you know, people that really have no interest in using it as an installation environment can still get that script and, you know, generate their own little Debian CD for whatever their particular task is.
Does it take 2 days to get to X configured, like Gen 2 does?
Sorry, I missed the beginning of that question.
Does it take 2 days to get X working, like Gen 2 does when you do the Gen 2 install?
2 days, is that what you said?
Yeah, 2 days.
Well, no, I mean, it probably takes that long because you're compiling from source with Gen 2, right?
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. I've done Gen 2 installs, and they can be pretty harsh.
Right. I mean, and you're compiling from source not just X, but all of the packages that it depends on all the way down through the C compiler, if I remember correctly. No, this doesn't go that route. Basically, when you run the installation from this CD, it will unpack the base system onto your hard disk, which is the same thing that the regular Debian installer will do. Then you reboot into that base system, and it has enough components on there that your network is working, your apt is working, your deselector or aptitude or whatever tool you prefer to use. And from there, then you install the rest of the system, normally from binary packages. It is one other project I've been working on is a tool called SourceInst, SRCINST. It's mostly just a proof of concept tool right now, but I've been interested in automatically building Debian packages and their dependencies from source, kind of like a Gen 2 or one of the BSDs can do. That's not really something that most people would have a desire to do on Debian, but I just kind of out of interest to see if we could do it.
John, I want to thank you for coming on. It's been great talking to
you. Thank you very much for having me. You guys have a really great show going on here, and I don't know, I just heard about it when you sent me an email. I wish I would have heard about it about 100 episodes ago here.
That's okay. That's what the archives are there for. Go back and download them.
So they're specifically right for you, John.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, a couple of other quick questions. Mm-hmm. What desktop manager are you running there, or window manager? Which one do you prefer?
I use KDE, and I don't know. It's not really because I think that KDE is particularly exceptionally excellent or anything. I'm not one of the rabid fans of it, but it's mainly because I like the way that things are integrated in KDE better than in GNOME or some of the other options. You know, one of the things that when I tried GNOME last time, I don't remember exactly what version it was. It was probably about 6 months ago. That I could not figure out a single place to go to define file associations. So I might define them in one place, and it would take for a few applications, and then some others would still not see that preference and do something else. You know, that was just kind of one example of you know, I thought, you know, this should really work better in an integrated system. But I don't really have strong feelings on it, and I run some GNOME applications under KDE, and they work fine, which is, you know, kind of neat. You know, they they'd be aware of the taskbar and everything else, even across the distributions. Not distributions, but desktop environments.
So now, you being a programmer, what editor do you prefer? Are you Emacs or VI?
You're just trying to get me in trouble, aren't you?
Yeah, well,
these are standard questions.
I use Emacs mostly, but I do use VI, especially when I'm in system administrator mode, because Emacs isn't always available everywhere. So I'm fluent enough with VI that I can get around with it when I need to. I also use VI for email, because Emacs takes long enough to start up that it annoys me.
You too.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're an old-time Debian user, you obviously use Debian package management utilities. Mm-hmm. And a question came over to IRC. How would you find out what a file a package belongs to? Wait. What file belongs
to? What package a file belongs to?
Yeah, what package a file belongs to? And the question was, you know, what if you wanted to find out what package the command ls came with? How would you do that?
Well, there are two different answers to that, and the answer depends on whether this package is already installed on your system, or if you're just have a random file in mind and you want to see where you could find a package that provides it. If a package is already on your system, you can use dpackage-S and then give it the file name, and it will search the. It treats that parameter as a wildcard, so you can give it a wildcard if you want to, but it will then search the dpackage database and tell you what package provided it. If you're looking for a file that's not already on your system, you want to find which Debian package provides it. There is a file out there on the Debian mirrors, and you go under Debian /dist/unstable or whatever, and it'll be contents-i386 or contents-alpha.gz, whatever architecture you're on. And that file has a listing of every single file that's provided by a Debian package in that distribution, as well as which package provides it. So that's where you use grep on that file, and then you can find out which packages you need to install if there's a particular file you're after.
All right.
Thanks for the tips.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great, yeah. We appreciate the work you're doing. Did you make that live CD available to the public?
Yeah, you can find it. It's on people.debian.org/tildejgoerzen. That's JGOERZEN /DFS, which stands for Debian from Scratch.
Wait, what was that again? Can you repeat that? People.debian.org.
People.debian.org/tildejgoerzen. JGOERZEN /DFS.
All right.
And there's an ISO image that they can download there. And if they're wanting to be able to build their own image, there's a package in Debian itself called DFS Build that they can install. And that will let you basically build your own ISO image.
All right, John, thank you very much for coming on. And keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you. You too.
We'll see about touching base with you again in the near future.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. Bye bye.
Dun 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 dun.
And that was John.
Dun 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 dun.
Sounds like he's been using Debian for a long time.
Yeah, about a year and a half now, right?
6 months or so.
A little bit of Debian. Yeah.
So next week we're talking to Dan Dennedy from the Kino Project. I'm looking forward to that interview.
So everybody come with your video editing
Kino
questions. How was Alan's vacation?
Sucked.
Didn't go anywhere, huh?
There's no other nice way to put it. No.
From York to Atlantic City.
Yeah, from York to Atlantic
City. Tim McGraw, the world tour.
Oh, God, no. It's. I have to take my wife to these things to keep peace in the house on it. And once a year I get stuck doing this. And it ruins my vacation every year.
Did you have fun in Atlantic City at least?
Atlantic City I walked around. I don't gamble much. So, you know, for me a lot of, you know, just standing in a machine dumping or at a table or something dumping money. I don't have enough to do that with.
It gets tired pretty quick.
That and after Labor Day, I think they stopped sweeping like the homeless off the boardwalk.
Yeah.
Because they were everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was really, really bad.
Atlantic City's a freaking dump, man.
Well, Atlantic City is a dump, yes, but...
Don't feed the cats.
Don't feed the cats. I took pictures of the cats, but... Because I was bored, and I was just, like, wandering around with my camera. But, you know, it was... I don't gamble a lot, so I don't drink. So there was, like, nothing for me to do while my wife's in at the shows.
If you're in Vegas, man, you could have went to the gun store.
Well, it was in Vegas, there's a million different things you can do.
Skydiving.
Because I've done that when, you know, we went out a couple years ago, and one of her, it was for Tim McGraw as well, on it. And one of the other country people that she follows was there. I was like, well, here, you know, take money, buy the ticket, go. And while she was there, you know, I was out having fun. You know, it's just I enjoyed myself.
He was at the Bunny Ranch.
I wish it was at the Bunny Ranch.
He was at the Buddy Ranch.
No, but
the male version.
It was just the only thing I say that I did decently the whole week was I went to the Harley.
Deja vu.
I went to the Harley factory tour. That was about the only.
That's a cool place, man. I was at that.
Yeah, it's a nice tour, but you know, for like 45 minutes, I enjoyed my vacation. The rest of the time, it sucked.
There's a place on Tropicana. It's called the Gun Store. You can go in there and shoot full automatic weapons, man.
Well, next time I go to Vegas, I want to hit that place out in the desert where you can shoot the machine guns.
You don't have to go that far, man. This place is right on Tropicana Boulevard.
Well, yeah, by
it's in a range. It's in our range.
Well, this is out in they take you out in the middle of the desert and just like you know, hand you the Uzis to shoot.
I shot a Thompson, you know, a Tommy gun.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
You know, like I said, in Vegas, there's always something to do. Atlantic City, you know, it sucks.
We got to cut off of Ben Rev.
Good night, Ben Rev.
Good night, Ben Rev.
Well, we probably already cut off, but who knows. All right, now the real show.
Now the real show starts.
Yeah, that's it.
But Vegas is good for, like, a long weekend, man. After that, it gets a little tired, I think.
Well, I was out there it was a week the last time and 2 weeks the first time. There's enough to do. But
now the question, Alan, did you follow the tour buses from York to Atlantic City?
No, because it was Wednesday night was York, and then Friday and Saturday was Atlantic City, and I don't know where else they went between there. I get my wife on the phone. She can tell you exactly where they were.
She's got a GPS.
The hilarious thing was, she's a member of the fan club. Surprise, surprise. She's a member of the fan club. So they had a pre-party show, which I guess is something they do at all the different shows. If you're a member of the fan club, you can go wait in line like 6 hours before the show starts on it. And then an hour before the show, he comes in and does this like little it's a meet and greet, and he does like three songs or something. The freaks. I'm sorry, they were freaks. She's always showing me the emails these people put out on it, because she like reads it all the time, and the emails are hilarious. These people are like, "Oh, Timmy's part of my family" type emails. You get there, and these people really believe this.
Hey man, it's all relevant.
They all stand there because you know she went down the line. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. On it, the meet and greet isn't until like 9. On it, they don't start even giving out the wristbands for it till like 6. And these people are like, yeah, they've got like little portfolios. Like, look, I got a picture like this, and I got this picture with them. It's like, oh my god,
everybody needs something in their lives, man.
Well, yeah, but
it's a little too much.
I know hardcore deadheads that were similar to this sort of thing. So I guess it happens with every performer. On it, but yeah, it's always funny to watch.
Star Trek convention?
But it's not funny when it's your family.
Well, yeah, because I get dragged along to these things. But thankfully, I don't go to the shows anymore. I just like I can't do this anymore. It's just It was like, you know, an hour and a half worth of like nails dragging across a chalkboard.
Come on, man! You went to the freaking Dead concerts.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it.
What the fuck is that?
Well, yeah, space and drums. Space and drums, I always hated.
What is
that that's one of those things. Either you're, you know, you like it or you. There were certain songs that I couldn't stand, but for the most part, I went there to enjoy the people as well, because going to a Dead show is like watching.
Have you been to a Dead concert? I have once, man. Once was enough.
I went to a couple dozen.
Yeah,
but,
years ago.
But, you know, it was, you know, watching them was hilarious. You know, just watching the people, you know, were hilarious. And even now, when I go to shows, I spend more time watching people.
You ever go to the Fish concert? It's like all the dead people, they moved on to Fish.
That's because they had nowhere else to go. They had to go follow
now,
Fish.
Now that's gone. Now it's Dave Matthews, I think.
No, there's a couple other jam bands out there now. Dave Matthews always had his own
I never
following.
Got into Dave Matthews, man. It seems to me like it's almost like, I don't know, like preppy rock, like these prep guys or whatever.
He's another one you either like or you don't. He's got a couple of good songs, but you know, for the most part, I don't listen to him.
So music is all subjective, man. It's like, you know, different strokes for different folks.
Well, yeah, I did the country thing like in high school when it was a fad. And then I realized I really hated this music.
Country music is like any other music. There's good and bad in it. I mean, if you really want to get really into country music, man, listen to like old Johnny Cash songs. Man.
Well, yeah, the
awesome stuff.
Yeah, the country music that's out there now is not really country.
It's
pop
music.
Yeah, it's pop music. But you know, the older stuff I would listen to, and you know, I've been, you know, guilty of hitting a couple of Willie Nelson shows on my own.
Yeah,
Willie
Nelson's cool. This good stuff, man. It's good and bad. Like
guy's 70 years old, smoking pot still. Yeah, come on.
Who?
Willie Nelson.
Oh, Willie Nelson.
You gotta love that shit.
Not Tim McGraw, right?
I don't know, and I don't care.
His buddy, what's the other guy there? Kenny Chesney, he was married to, what's her name, the actress, for like
you'll find out
4 months,
and
they got it annulled.
Yeah, you'll find out what really happens when he writes a song about it.
Oh, Kenny Chesney.
How'd this go depressingly onto a country music?
Country, man.
My mother-in-law
like some
likes, suddenly moved south and loves country music when she named her dog Chesney.
Oh, God.
And then got rid of her.
You know what's
and
really
moved
good?
Further south.
Bluegrass music is really good.
Well, yeah, I'll listen to that because I just like the bluegrass music,
really
you actually have to be a musician to play.
Yeah, finger-picking guitar, man, banjo, it's good stuff, man.
Quite a lot of the other stuff coming out nowadays you don't have to actually be a musician for.
What was that guy who did country and then he changed his name? What was it, to Chris Black or something, and tried to do rock and then went back to country?
Talking about Garth Brooks, he did one album.
Yeah, that's what did he change his name to?
What happened was he was supposedly going to come out with a movie. And he was going to be in the movie as the main character. So he wrote, like, a whole album of, like, rock music. And he recorded it and released it. And then the movie never happened. So people were looking at him like, you know, what the hell is this freak doing?
What was his name? What was his
Garth Brooks.
Yeah, but what did he change his name to?
Chris something. Chris, I forget.
Is it Chris Black?
No, it was Chris something else. I forget. Chris Gaines.
Chris Gaines, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Chris Gaines.
Yeah. So it was like this whole other alter ego he did.
Chris Gaines and Chris Gaines. Gaines. Who was that? Chris Gaines? Somebody on the chat tell me again, please. Question was, how did the Dell laptop with the bad XP licenses work out? Well, it didn't. I mean, it's there, but we're in the process of purchasing licenses for it. We can't upgrade it or update it. Not upgrade. Update it till we get a license. If you read my blog, it was a big pain in the butt. And apparently, unless you're so
bedtime, Dan.
Yeah, some workaround that you can't transfer a license from a old machine to a new one. You know, like a lot of new machines these days come with the license tag on the side. If you buy like an HP, is there one on there?
I think there's one underneath it.
Underneath. Well, their HP died. The hard drive, everything died. So we had an older Dell. We're going to take the license off the HP and use it on the Dell. It wouldn't work.
Really?
I tried other licenses that were on dead machines, too. And they won't. They wouldn't let me put it.
Yeah, I got a license thing on the bottom of it.
So, you know, when you think about it, you get whacked twice for the tax there. If you do it legitimately, you buy the machine, and you pay for the license. And then if you want to transfer it to another machine, you can't. So you got to buy another license. So you got whacked twice, so you can't use this. You know.
Just say no.
That's it. Yeah, just say no. So, you know, that's what you got to say. You know, if you're going to play that game, you're going to have to pay the price. That's why I don't play it anymore. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, people ask, well, you know, Windows, why don't they just, you know, give away or not restrict the older versions of Windows, like 3.1
or they want your money.
95 or whatever. And you think about it, if they did that, nobody would use, no one would use the new ones. They'd just stay at the old ones because, I don't know.
The old ones sort of worked.
That's the way it be. Well, I guess we're closing up the shop for tonight. It's past 10. It's past bin rev time. Let's play some music out of here. Next week we're coming back, hopefully with everybody. Unless Alan's going to another Tim McGraw concert.
Nope. That's,
you're done with Tim McGraw for the season?
I'm done. I'm done for a year.
Did your wife ever get backstage on any of those?
Oh, shit. She actually got... Right at the pre-party, she got right up to the stage with them, and got like, you know, autographs and shit.
Do better, give her more than autographs. Better cut off a finger and give it to her. Holy mackerel!
She said she grabbed on and didn't want to let go, but
I grabbed on to what?
Well, I didn't ask, and I don't really care.
Oh my god!
She's managed to get like autographs from like everybody in the band and stuff. So
it's devotion. You know, I don't understand that about
sickness.
Women. Because they really latch on to, like my wife is really into Enterprise.
Connor Trenere.
And Connor Trenere. Yeah. And there's, like, hordes of these women.
Chicks love that
they're
guy.
Into the, to like, and, like, you know, I said to her the other day, I said, you know what? It's really odd for me to not think of this as, like, any kind of, like, sexual feelings involved there, because apparently that's not the case. Like I look at it like if a guy has like pictures of a chick, chances are it's like some stripper or a model or something, and there's some sexual fantasy going on there, and usually they have nude pictures and stuff like that. So you know, but it's called
a porn collection.
Yeah, yeah, it's called. But women, I guess it doesn't work the same way for women.
Women are very different.
This is really it's
well,
weird.
It was hilarious because like last year, the year before, actually, she dragged me up to Mohegan Sun, which is up in Connecticut.
I've been
out there. Nice place and all.
Sorry, yes, yeah. Up there.
Yeah, but we get on the elevator, and she really likes the bass player of the band.
Tim McGraw.
Yeah. We get on the elevator and we go down one floor, and she had seen the guy like earlier, like walking around, and she's like,
"She knew where his room was."
He's walking around the casino, so we're going down to go get dinner. Get on the elevator, goes down one floor, and who the fuck gets on the elevator?
Bass player.
But the bass player. My wife went completely white on it, to the point of like, and so you know, I'm like, you know, I'm being nice because she's like, you know, she gets as far as like, hello. And then freezes starts up. To like, you know, that. So, you know, I shook the guy's hand. He was very nice. I said hello and took a picture. We got the picture developed. The picture, she is fucking white. She's like, white as your shirt, Dan. And it's like, okay, maybe you want to like calm down next time you meet one of these people.
I got a good casino concert story. I was out in Vegas about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And me and my buddies, we heard that the Allman Brothers were playing at the Aladdin, so we went to it.
God,
we got so hammered, man, at these shows in Vegas. If you're watching a concert, the waitresses go around with, you know, serving drinks and taking drink orders, man. We got so smashed at that show, man. And then afterwards, we're out in the casino, and we're playing blackjack, and who happens to sit down next to us and deal in, you know, to get in their hand, but Greg Allman. Pretty cool.
When the guy got on the elevator, Alan had an erection.
No. I went to go see Almonds once down at Garden State Arts Center, whatever it's called now.
PNC.
Yeah, I forgot my earplugs on it. The very first, all really the guy odd? Did was, the guy opened up and introduced a hot tuna. on. He hit this note that, like, blew my eardrums out. And for the rest of, like, 3 hours, we had 3 drums, 90-minute, like, drum things going on in this thing. It was most... I'll never go again. It was the fucking most... worst concert I've ever gone to.
Really?
And I actually happen to like Allman Brothers, but I will never go see them in concert again.
Who?
Allman Brothers. Oh. But I'll never go see them in concert again, because it just, like, it went on. And it was, and you know, when you can't hear, it's even worse, because, you know, Garden State Arts Center, the acoustics suck in the first place.
Oh, man.
But it just, like, it was one of these shows that just went on and on and on. And even my friend, who had seen them dozens of times.
I went to one Allman Brothers concert one time. I actually fell asleep during the drum solo.
We went through 3 of those drum solos. Even my friend, like I said, who's seen them a dozen times, he was like, my God, that has been the longest one I ever went to.
I mean, I was a little inebriated, but I did pass out for about 20 minutes.
I would have loved to have been able to pass
out. I went to a concert. David Lee Roth was the headliner. And,
what year was that,
87? This is like 91, I think. And it was Extreme, I think Cinderella, and somebody else.
Sounds like a opening. Cool lineup.
Yeah, but we got there. We had been drinking an awful lot before we got there.
Who passed out?
And I passed out from when I think it was Extreme opened up all the way to the end of Cinderella. So I was like, good, I don't like those pussies anyway. So I slept through all of those.
I had a friend who did that at one of the outdoor arena shows. It was back when they put, like, you know, 4, you know, hair metal bands and shit on, you know, like, down in Philly at one of the arenas. He passed out at the first one.
And spent the rest.
we picked him up in the hospital tent on the way out.
I got to smoke that, too. Me and my friends, we went to see Robert Plant, and my friends... We were really hammered. We put away like a bottle of scotch between like 3 of us, and my friend Scott was pretty loaded, and he took off like the first song in, and he didn't come back, and we're out in the parking lot getting ready to leave, and then sure enough, there's Scott. He what happened was he passed out in the concourse. We dragged him back to the freaking first aid station, and he woke up 5 minutes before the end of the concert.
Oh, that sucks.
See,
these days you can't afford to get drunk at a concert because
back then it
cost too much money. Like, yeah, this would be.
Good night, everybody. I'm plugging here.
Good night, Al.
Like, the Queen tickets. I wanted to go see Queen. They were $180. Like, wow, that's like a mortgage payment.
That's ridiculous.
To go to see a concert.
Right.
That's a car payment. Well. Yeah, Mercury's dead. It's not even the original line. I mean, everybody else is the same. But, you know, whatever.
It's money, 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 money. That's all it's about these days.
That's it.
All righty.
We're
going to wrap it up.
Play the song out.
What are you going to play?
Just crap.
Okay.
There we go.
Good night.
Conan, what is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women. That is good.
You were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. It's over.
That's it.